This week, Chapter 4 of Ancient Modern Initiation by Max Heindel, The Ark of the Covenant. What was it? How did a voice emanate from a cloud between two cherubim? What is the Ark in relation to the human body? Then we'll have a brand new Masonic Minute with illustrious Brother Harrison as he tells us little-known facts about Brother Nat King Cole. How did he get that King in the middle of his name? Why did his television show get canceled after only two seasons? We'll move on with a short biographical piece on Enrico Fermi, a brother who is considered the architect of the nuclear age. When did he join Freemasonry? What were his views on nuclear technology as a weapon? And what was his legacy for humanity? Finally, we'll wrap it all up with a book review, newly published to paperback, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Freemasonry in the Civil War by Most Worshipful Brother, Past Grand Master, Michael Halloran. All this and more. Stick around.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 479. As you heard in the top of the show, we've got a great one lined up for you, including a wonderful Masonic Minute with illustrious Brother Stephen L. Harrison. I want to go ahead and give a shout out to our producers, fellows, contributors, and our legacy partners. Thank you so much, and I want to express to everybody out there just how grateful I am to be able to continue to bring this show to you week after week, month after month, year after year. If you want to know how you can assist this podcast in bringing Masonic education weekly edification to all those interested, and especially brothers and those interested in Freemasonry, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see how you can help. In the news, I just released and published a brand new book called How to Charter a Lodge, a No-Nonsense, Unsanctioned Guide. And the main purpose of this book was I had been fielding questions for the last 3 years about how to charter a lodge, and people were saying, I wish I knew how to do it. And we've published a number of articles, whether on Midnight Freemasons or other blogs, saying that if you want change in Masonry, you have to be the person to bring that change. And a lot of times that comes with the territory of just having to start a new lodge. And so what I would say is that this is an unsanctioned, unofficial guide to starting a new Masonic lodge. If you're tired of the same old thing at your lodge, you want more, whether that's education, fellowship, or even more pancakes. Whatever the reason is, this is the no-nonsense look at what to really expect when taking the steps to charter a new Masonic lodge. This guide is going to cover the challenges, the naysayers, the paperwork, and more. You'll get some critical insights as well from members of Masonic organizations from around the world on what to expect and how to navigate this process. I was lucky enough to get Most Worshipful Brother Bob Davis to go ahead and contribute. I have a number of other brothers and sisters at large who have contributed to the work with their own insight when they were working to charter new organizations. The book comes in at about 150 pages or so. I think there's 2 pages for notes in the print version. There are no pages for notes, obviously, in the Kindle version, but both are available now. You can get them on Amazon, on Kindle, or you can order from me direct on WCYpodcast.com. Just click the link, and there'll be a slight delay as I'm still waiting to get my author edition copies. And also, just so you know, that when you do order from me on the website, you can choose to go ahead and add the Hello Hiram pin as well. Now, enough about all of that. If you're interested, go check it out. It's on the WCY podcast in the shop. Links will be in the show notes. Let's get right into this week's first piece. And we're starting off with Chapter 4 of Max Heindel's Ancient and Modern Initiation. If you missed previous chapters, I invite you to go back into previous episodes. We've already read Chapters 1, 2, and 3. Here goes Chapter 4, The Ark of the Covenant. It is noteworthy, and fraught with great mystic significance, that the aroma of voluntary service is represented as sweet-smelling, fragrant incense, while the odor of sin, selfishness, and transgression of the law represented by compulsory sacrifice upon the altar of service is nauseating, for it needs no great imagination to understand that the cloud of smoke which went up continually from the burning carcasses of the sacrificial animals created nauseating stench to show the exceeding loathsomeness of it, while the perpetual incense offered upon the altar before the second veil showed, by antithesis, the beauty and sublimity of selfless service, thus exhorting the mystic mason, as a child of light, to shun the one and cleave to the other. Let it be understood also that service does not consist in doing great things only. Some of the heroes, so-called, were mean and small in their general lives, and rose only to the occasion upon the great and notable day. Martyrs have been put on the calendar of saints because they died for a cause. But it is a greater martyrdom sometimes to do the little things that no one notices, and sacrifice self in simple service to others. We have seen previously that the veil at the entrance to the outer court and the veil in front of the east room of the tabernacle were both made in four colors, blue, red, purple, and white. But the second veil, which divided the east room of the tabernacle from the west room, differs with respect to makeup from the other two. It was wrought with the figures of cherubim. We will not consider, however, the significance of this fact until we take up the subject of the new moon and initiation, but will now look into the second apartment of the tabernacle, the western room, called the Most Holy, or the Holy of Holies. Beyond the second veil, into this second apartment no mortal might ever pass save the high priest, and he was only allowed to enter on one occasion in the whole year, namely Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, and then only after the most solemn preparation and with the most reverential care. The holiest of all was clothed with the solemnity of another world. It was filled with an unearthly grandeur. The whole tabernacle was the sanctuary of God. But here, in this place, was the awful abode of His presence, the special dwelling place of the Shekinah glory, and, well might mortal man tremble to present himself within these sacred precincts, as the high priest must do on the Day of Atonement. In the western end of this apartment, the western end of the whole tabernacle, rested the Ark of the Covenant. It was a hollow receptacle containing the golden pot of manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the tables of the law, which were given to Moses. While this Ark of the Covenant remained in the tabernacle in the wilderness, two staves were always within the four rings of the Ark, so that it could be picked up instantly and moved when the Ark was finally taken to Solomon's temple. The staves were taken out. This is very important in its symbolical significance. Above the ark hovered the cherubim, and between them dwelt the uncreated glory of God. "Three," said he to Moses, "I will meet with thee, and I will commune with thee from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim, which are upon the ark of the testimony." The glory of the Lord seen above the mercy seat was in the appearance of a cloud. The Lord said to Moses, quote, "Speak unto Aaron, thy brother, that he come not at all time into the holiest place within the veil before the mercy seat, which is upon the ark, that he die not, for I will appear in the cloud upon the mercy seat." End quote. This manifestation of the divine presence was called among the Jews the Shekinah glory. Its appearance was attended, no doubt, with a wonderful spiritual glory of which it is impossible to form any proper conception. Out of this cloud the voice of God was heard with deep solemnity when He was consulted in behalf of the people. When the aspirant has qualified to enter this place behind the second veil, he finds everything dark to the physical eye, and it is necessary that he should have another light within. When he first came to the eastern temple gate, he was poor, naked, and blind, asking for light. He was then shown the dim light, which appeared in the smoke above the altar of sacrifice, and told that in order to advance he must kindle within himself that flame by remorse for wrongdoing. Later on he was shown the more excellent light in the east room of the tabernacle, which proceeded from the seven-branched candlestick. In other words, he was given the light of knowledge and of reason, that by it he might advance further upon the path. But it was required that by service he should evolve himself and around himself another light, the golden wedding garment, which is also the Christ light of the soul body. By lives of service, this glorious soul substance gradually pervades his whole aura, until it is ablaze with a golden light. Not until he has evolved this inner illumination can he enter into the darkened precincts of the second tabernacle, as the most holy place is sometimes called. God is light. If we walk in the light, as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another. This is generally taken to indicate only the fellowship of the saints, but as a matter of fact it applies also to the fellowship which we have with God. When the disciple enters the second tabernacle, the light within himself vibrates to the light of the Shekinah glory between the cherubim, and he realizes the fellowship with his Father Fire, as the cherubim and the Father Fire, which hover above the ark, represent the divine hierarchies which overshadow mankind during his pilgrimage through the wilderness. So the ark which is found there represents man in his highest development. Three were, as already said, three things within the ark: the golden pot of manna, the budding rod, and the tables of the law. When the aspirant stood at the eastern gate as a child of sin, the law was without as a taskmaster to bring him to Christ. It exacted with unrelenting severity an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Every transgression brought a just recompense, and man was circumscribed on every hand by laws commending him to do certain things and refrain from doing others. But when, through sacrifice and service, he has finally arrived at the stage of evolution represented by the ark in the western room of the tabernacle, the tables of the law are within. He has then become emancipated from all outside interference with his actions. Not that he would break any laws, but because he works with them. Just as we have learned to respect the proper right of others, and have therefore become emancipated from the commandment, "Thou shalt not steal," so he who keeps all laws because he wants to do so has, on that account, no longer need of an exterior taskmaster, but gladly renders obedience in all things because he is a servant of the law and works with it from choice and not through necessity. The golden pot of manna. Manas, or mannas, mensch, mens, or man, is readily associated with the manna that came down from heaven. It is the human spirit that descended from our Father above for a pilgrimage through matter, and the golden pot wherein it was kept symbolizes the golden aura of the soul body. Although the Bible story is not in strict accordance with the events, it gives the main facts of the mystic manna which fell from heaven. When we want to learn what is the nature of this so-called bread, we may turn to the 6th chapter of the Gospel of John, which relates how Christ fed the multitudes with loaves and fishes, symbolizing the mystic doctrine of the 2,000 years, which he was then ushering in. For during that time, the sun, by precession of the equinox, has been passing through the sign of the fishes, Pisces, and the people have been taught to abstain at least one day during the week, Friday, and at a certain time of the year, from the flesh pots which belong to Egypt, or ancient Atlantis. They have been given the Piscean water at the temple door, and the Virginian wafers at the communion table, before the altar, when they worshipped the Immaculate Virgin, representing the celestial sign Virgo, which is opposite the sign of Pisces, and entered communion with the Son, begotten by her. Christ also explained at that time in the mystic but unmistakable language what the living bread or manna was, namely the ego. The explanation will be found in verses 33 and 35, where we read, quote, "For the bread of God is he which cometh down from heaven and giveth light unto the world. I am, or ego sum, the bread of life," end quote. This, then, is the symbol of the golden pot of manna which was found in the ark. This manna is the ego of human spirit which gives life to the organisms that we behold in the physical world. It is hidden within the ark of each human being, and the golden pot or soul body or wedding garment is also latent within everyone. It is made more massive, lustrous, and resplendent by the spiritual alchemy whereby service is transmuted to soul growth. It is the house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens, wherewith Paul longed to be clothed, as said in the epistle to the Corinthians. Everyone who is striving to aid his fellow men thereby garners within himself that golden treasure laid up in heaven, where neither moth nor rust can destroy it. Aaron's Rod. An ancient legend relates that when Adam was expelled from the Garden of Eden, he took with him three slips of the Tree of Life, which were then planted by Seth. The second son of Adam is, according to the Masonic legend, father of the spiritual hierarchy of churchmen, working with humanity through Catholicism, while the three sons of Cain are the craftsmen of the world. The latter are active in Freemasonry, promoting material and industrial progress, as builders of the Temple of Solomon the universe should be. The three sprouts planted by Seth have had important missions in the spiritual development of humanity, and one of them is said to be the Rod of Aaron. In the beginning of concrete existence, generation was carried on under the wise guidance of the angels, who saw to it that the creative act was accomplished at times when the interplanetary rays of force were propitious, and man was also forbidden to eat of the tree of knowledge. The nature of that tree is readily determined from such sentences as, quote, "Adam knew his wife, and she bore Cain. Adam knew his wife, and she bore Seth. How shall I bear a child, seeing that I know not a man?" As said by Mary to the angel Gabriel, in the light of this interpretation, the statement of the angel, it was not a curse, when he discovered that his precepts had been disobeyed, namely, quote-unquote, "dying thou shalt die," is also intelligible, for the bodies generated regardless of cosmic influence could not be expected to persist. Hence man was exiled from the etheric realms of spiritual force, Eden, where grows the tree of vital power, exiled to concrete existence in the dense physical bodies which he has made for himself by generation. This was surely a blessing, for who has a body sufficiently good and perfect in his own estimation that he would like to live in it forever? Death, then, is a boon to the spiritual realms for a season, and build better vehicles each time we return to earth life. As Oliver Wendell Holmes says, quote, "Build thee more stately mansions, O my soul, as the swift seasons roll. Leave thy low-vaulted past, let each new temple nobler than the last. Shut tree from heaven with a dome more vast, till thou at length art free, leaving thine outgrown shell by life's unresting sea." End quote. In the course of time, when we learn to shun the pride of life and the lust of the flesh, generation will cease to sap our vitality. The vital energy will then be used for regeneration, and the spiritual powers symbolized by Aaron's rod will be developed. The wand of the magician, the holy spear of Percival, the Grail King, and the budding rod of Aaron are emblems of this divine creative force, which works wonders of such a nature that we call them miracles. But let it be clearly understood that no one who has evolved to the point in evolution where he is symbolized by the Ark of the Covenant in the west room of the tabernacle ever uses this power for selfish ends. When Percival, the hero of the soul myth by that name, had witnessed the temptation of Kundry and proved himself to be emancipated from the greatest sin of all, the sin of lust and unchastity, he recovered that the sacred spear taken by the black magician Klingsor from the fallen and unchaste Rail King Amfortas. Then, for many years he traveled in the world seeking again the castle of the Grail, and he said, quote, "Often was I sorely beset by enemies and tempted to use the spear in self-defense, but I knew that the sacred spear must never be used to hurt, only to heal." End quote. And that is the attitude of everyone who develops within him the budding rod of Aaron. Though he may turn this spiritual faculty to good account in order to provide bread for a multitude, he would never think of turning a single stone to bread for himself, that his hunger might be appeased. Though he were nailed to the cross to die, he would not free himself by spiritual power which he had readily exercised to save others from the grave. Though he were reviled every day of his life as a fraud or charlatan, he would never misuse his spiritual power to show a sign whereby the world might know without the shadow of a doubt that he was regenerate or heaven-born. This was the attitude of Christ Jesus, and it has been and is imitated by everyone who is a Christ in the making. So there you have chapter 5. This chapter really hits the New Age idea of the inner Christ, a concept which is really represented in a multitude of different secret traditions. I think the question for this week is going to relate to the idea of doing for others before doing for yourself. So for a Craftsman Plus, I'd like to ask, tell me about a time where you made a conscious decision where your first inclination was to be selfish, but ultimately gave something away. We can use this as an exercise to come together and see that this truly is a struggle at times. And now let's go ahead and get into this week's Masonic Minute with illustrious brother, Stephen L. Harrison.
Nat King Cole, a member of Thomas Waller Lodge 49 in Los Angeles and a 33rd degree Scottish Rite Mason, was an American jazz pianist, singer, and one of the first African Americans to have his own television show. Since his death, he has remained enormously popular worldwide, adding 5 posthumous Grammys to the single one he received during his lifetime. In 1991, Cole's daughter Natalie released a duet with videos of her father singing one of his great hits, Unforgettable, winning the 1992 Grammy for Record of the Year. He has 2 stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, one for his work in television and one for his music. Cole was an active and outspoken participant in the civil rights movement, often lamenting the fact that entertainers such as himself were accepted in many situations where African Americans of other professions were not. Recognizing his activism, both Presidents Kennedy and Johnson invited him to the White House during their term. His television show, which aired in 1956 and 1957, had high ratings and enjoyed critical praise. However, in spite of the fact that he was accepted in some entertainment circles, the show was dropped after 2 seasons because national advertisers would not support a black man. At a young age, Brother Nat struggled to get his career off the ground. He went broke and, in his words, was forced to play in every joint from San Diego to Bakersfield. It was in one of those dives that an inebriated customer stuck a hat on his head, called it a crown, and in a play on his last name, dubbed him Old King Cole. The nickname stuck, and Cole, truly a king in the world of music, forever became Nat King Cole. Brother Cole owed his success to a soft baritone voice. He was convinced smoking enhanced his rich singing tone and maintained a 3-pack-a-day habit during his adult years. Prior to each recording session, he would smoke several cigarettes in quick succession to enhance the effect. Regrettably, the practice took his life in 1965 when he died of lung cancer at the young age of 45. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
Wow. What can I say? You know, you don't really hear too much about some of these entertainer Freemasons outside of the idea of possibly their involvement in the Shriners International or something along those lines. To hear some of this about Brother Nat King Cole was really interesting to me because I had known about his musical career, his bad habit in smoking and all of these things, but I was really unaware of his activism in terms of social justice and these types of things. But it was awesome to hear about. How sad was it that, you know, his great show on television had to be taken away because of a lack of advertisements or advertisers who would not support a show that put a man of color on the TV screen? It's just amazing to me. You know, and frequently we say, well, it was back then, you know, we're up in this time now and things are different. But I'm always left wondering, you know, at what point was it ever okay to do these kinds of things? But I also understand the current argument of not judging the past by the standards of today. which I think is both a true statement, but also one that is not as true as it could be, perhaps. You know, it's a nuanced thing to contemplate for sure. But I want to thank illustrious Brother Harrison for his work in putting this episode together. If you want to catch the video that goes along with it, head on over to our YouTube channel, Whence Came You, where we publish the videos separately as well, and you can check it out there and really enjoy it. Now, if you really love the Masonic Minute segments, you can, of course, find that YouTube channel as well. I'll put a link in the show notes to it. But more importantly, Brother Stephen L. Harrison has written several books on Freemasonry and edited several others. If you would like to check those out, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on the bookstore, and you can check out all of the books that he has either written or edited. And of course, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that he was the editor of the Freemason magazine in Missouri for several years, and he works heavily with the Missouri Lodge of Research. Now, that's MOLOR.org. Molor.org is where you want to go to join the Missouri Lodge of Research. It is open to people outside of Missouri. I myself submitted a petition not long ago, and I am proud to support that organization. Next up, I have another somewhat biographical piece that I wanted to share with you that comes from the philosophicalsociety.org, which is, you know, the Masonic Philosophical Society's website. They published a blog post on November 8th, 2020 by Elaine Polonius Pellin, and you know I've read several of her works before on the website, but here it is. This is a really great biographical piece, and I think you'll enjoy it. Very interesting indeed, especially if you're like me and you think about physics and all things mathematics all the time. So here you go. Enrico Fermi, The Architect of the Nuclear Age, by Elaine Polonius Pellin, November 8, 2020. Referred to as the Architect of the Nuclear Age, Enrico Fermi was a nuclear physicist, a Nobel Prize winner, and a Freemason. Throughout his prolific career, he made substantial contributions to the fields of quantum theory, statistical mechanics, and nuclear and particle physics. Fermi excelled at both experimental and theoretical work, a distinction accomplished by few physicists. He labored for the betterment of humanity, yet his research ultimately led to the creation and utilization of the atomic bombs, which killed over 200,000 citizens of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan. Brother Enrico was adamantly opposed to the utilization of the hydrogen bomb, yet he ultimately argued for the development of knowledge regardless of the consequence of the use of that knowledge. Early years in Italy. Born in Rome in 1901, Enrico Fermi's fascination with physics began at age 14 following the tragic death of his older brother, Giulio. Distraught after losing his brother, he went to a local market and found two physics textbooks written by a Jesuit physicist in 1840. Despite the fact that the books were written in Latin, Fermi read them cover to cover. From that point on, Enrico's passion for physics became the focal point of his life. His understanding was so advanced in the subject that his entrance essay for the University of Pisa was deemed equivalent to the work of a doctoral student. There he received his undergraduate and doctoral degree, and he published his first important scientific work in 1922, his year of graduation. Enrico Fermi became a Freemason, joining Adriano Lemi Lodge in Rome under the Gran Loggia d'Italia di Piazza del Gesso. His intellectual curiosity made him a natural fit for the studies of Freemasonry, and he rose to the degree of Master Mason in 1923. His climb towards greatness continued as he was appointed professor of theoretical physics at the University of Rome at the age of 24. In the 1930s, he conducted a series of experiments to study the impacts of bombarding various elements with neutrons. This work led to the successful splitting of a uranium atom, for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1938. Fearing for the safety of his Jewish wife, Fermi began searching for an escape from the impending genocide. Soon after, Enrico and Laura emigrated to the United States, fleeing the fascist regime's takeover of Italy. Emigration to the United States. Upon the discovery of nuclear fission, he went to the University of Chicago and later to Los Alamos to serve as a general consultant. Brother Fermi contributed significantly to the Manhattan Project. As a leading member of the Manhattan Project, Brother Fermi worked on the development of nuclear energy and the atomic bomb, although he was a vocal critic of the use of the technology as a military weapon. Work in the Royal Society. Did Brother Fermi's Masonic career continue in his participation in the Royal Society? Some Masonic scholars have explored the hypothesis that modern Freemasonry was instituted in the 17th century by a set of philosophers and scientists who organized it under the title of the Royal Society. This political and philosophical club, subsequently referred to under many other names, including the Royal Society of Sciences, had many ties to the ancient fraternity of Freemasonry. The Royal Society is known today under the United Kingdom's National Academy of Sciences. Recently celebrating its 350th anniversary, the Library and Museum of Freemasonry held a special exhibition focused on the extraordinary number of Freemasons who have been fellows of this august body since its inception. Hundreds of Royal Society fellows have belonged to the craft, including several royals such as King George IV, Oscar I of Sweden and Norway, and H.R.H., the Duke of Kent. Other notable members of the Society include Sir Winston Churchill, Voltaire, Benjamin Franklin, and Edward Jenner. Brother Fermi was elected Fellow of the Royal Society on April 27, 1950. In his later years, he did important work in particle physics and was an inspiring teacher at the University of Chicago. Unfortunately, in 1954, at the age of 54, Brother Enrico died of stomach cancer due to his exposure to radiation in his experiments. His legacy of service to humanity continues long after his death. Fermi stated, quote, "Whatever nature has in store for mankind, unpleasant as it may be, men must accept, for ignorance is never better than knowledge." End quote. Does the expansion of knowledge, even when applied to controversial ends, always benefit humanity? And this concludes this short biography of Enrico Fermi, brother who died at another early age, not unlike Brother Nat King Cole, 45, Enrico Fermi, 54, and similarly, they both died from things inherent to their profession. Nat King Cole believed that the smoking gave him his great voice, and Enrico Fermi died due to exposure of the radioactive element that he was consistently working with. And the last piece that I have for you this week actually is a blog post that I wrote a few years ago, but with a new editor's note, because the book has enjoyed such success that it is now available in paperback. And I want to just go ahead and read this because this is not an advertisement in any way, shape, or form. However, I do recommend the book. Now in paperback, The Better Angels of Our Nature, a review by Midnight Freemason contributor Robert H. Johnson. Editor's note, this review was first published a few years ago. However, I have updated it because it is now out in paperback. I, for one, am very excited about this. You can pick up the new paperback at this link. Several years ago, I reviewed an older book, which I found to be excellent. It was called A House Undivided. I followed this up about a year later with a similar book, in that the subject matter was the same. However, this particular book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Freemasonry in the American Civil War, is not so much a collection of colorful anecdotes as the previous book had been. Instead, it was a real investigation into Civil War stories, verified using real scholarly work. Many Civil War stories have embellishments and unbelievable outcomes. This new book cleared it all up. In the first chapter, it opens up with a doorbuster. Using all of the resources available and even written accounts, Halloran proves that Hancock and Armistead's highly regarded story never happened. This story, forever memorialized in the Friend to a Friend Masonic Memorial at Gettysburg, and also the basis of the 26th degree in the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite of the Northern Masonic Jurisdiction, is false. It's a great story, but it just isn't true. After that substantial, disappointing blow, the book goes on, and I prepared myself for further disappointments. But my disappointment was staved off. Instead, I had confirmation after confirmation of even more amazing stories regarding the influence of the gentle craft in wartime. In fact, many of the stories which were confirmed were more fantastic than any other stories I had heard before. Stories that pulled at your heartstrings and made you think about the times and situations these brothers had been in. Cover to cover, the book draws you in. The book's overwhelming and underlying question or theme seems to be, what was it about the Masonic obligation that superseded the rules of war? This was a question that the book guides you into asking yourself as you hear story after story of verified fraternalism on the battleground. Stories of soldiers accidentally escaping and lodges being fashioned in prisons. Even enemy officers of those prison camps attending the prisoner-based lodges, all verified through journal entries and cross-reference in other journal entries by the actual brothers who were there. Mike Halloran even goes to the lengths of inspecting sources that were not Masonic. Journal entries by the profane of the period. In these entries, the profane complain that Masons got better treatment and even were let go on occasion. It was quote-unquote unfair. These profane often wrote in their journals of how, when the time would present itself, they too would join the fraternity, out of witnessing the bonds that had been on display to them during the war. The book does a fantastic job of verifying, separating truth from colorful anecdotes, and disproving Masonic whoppers. I say this book is a must-read. Where A House Undivided brings you the fairy tales, perhaps this book brings you the straight dope on what happened. And in the end, this book proves we are indeed the greatest fraternity in the world. Just recently, the book has been released for the first time as a paperback. If you've been waiting to pick this book up, now is the time. It's never been more accessible. Pick it up at this link. I'll have a link to the book in the show notes. It is available exclusively through the University of Alabama Press. I'll have a link to that in the bookstore as well. That is probably the only book in the bookstore that doesn't have some sort of affiliate sale going on with it to assist the program. This is strictly through the Alabama University Press. Is the best place to pick this book up. That's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed, and if you can't get enough Masonic education and you're looking for the next big thing, I have a presentation this upcoming Tuesday on Esoterics 101. The Zoom information for that presentation is on our website, wcypodcast.com, under the schedule. And then actually the next night I'll be doing the Tetragrammaton, the Lost Word, which is the Quantum Lecture Part 2, on Wednesday. And on Friday I'm doing Esoterics 101 with a live Portuguese translation. So that's what's going on the rest of the month in terms of education and presentations that I'm going to be a part of. I want to thank Publicity Lodge number 1000 in New York as they hosted John Ruark and I to do a presentation on It's Business Time. And it was awesome to be able to do that. So many thanks goes out to the brothers there, and in particular, Brother Doug, for setting it all up. Once more, I want to thank all of our producers, fellows, and contributors, and our legacy partners for making this show possible. If you want to know more about how to support the show, head on over to wcypodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and check out your available options. And one last plug, please check out the How to Charter a Lodge, a no-nonsense, unsanctioned guide, available right now on our website, on Amazon, and on Kindle. If you have blazed through the book already, then feel free to leave me a review, good, bad, indifferent. Everything helps. Of course, I always appreciate it. If you enjoyed the book, hop over there and leave us a 5-star review. Be awesome. And that's it. So until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.